You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel and Grain Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney & Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. That last one's always a little tough for me to say. Thank you for joining us on the Leaders and Legends podcast. Our guest today is Indiana Senator Todd Young, Senior Senator Todd Young, who is lifelong Hoosier and a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. We're, of course, very honored and thrilled to have him on. We're going to talk a lot of Army, Marine Corps smack today, but we'll do it respectfully. And we want to start with asking Senator Young how you're feeling about the current situation. It's obviously a time it's an unprecedented time of worry in many regards, and people bonding together to govern their own behavior for the greater good. We don't want to dwell on it, but you want to talk a little bit about your views of the current COVID crisis and what we're doing to handle it.
Yes, unprecedented, aptly describes the current situation, Robert. It's a public health crisis meets economic crisis meets social and community sort of disruption. I think we're all looking forward to getting our sort of regular cadence and pattern of our lives back, but. I think this is a time of great stress and strain for all Americans, but in particular, our frontline healthcare workers, so many individuals who went into this crisis already experiencing some of the things we're now hearing a lot about, we're now seeing a lot of the effects of. If you were lonely before the pandemic hit, you're probably really lonely right now. If you were feeling, ill before the pandemic, this is not a good time to be unwell. So you or loved ones may have succumbed to this wicked virus. And I think it's all, at the same time, though, made us all appreciate just how much we need one another. How much we appreciate one another. And Robert, as a strong Republican and someone who's proud of who I am and what I've stood for in a public sense, I'm not talking about people just like me. I mean, I really miss people very much unlike me right now, and the ability to mix with them on a regular basis and see them in casual public settings. And so it's this sort of defining moment in a person's life that one would hope would really heighten our appreciation for how much we value one another and are all in this same sort of challenge and predicament together. And so I think we got a real opportunity to build on this solidarity and come together into a more perfect union, a stronger nation on the back end of this.
One of the things that Hoosiers do really well is they lead, and there are many, many examples of that, of course, whether it's our six vice presidents, along with the current one, Mr. Pence, not only that, but frontline soldiers and command officers. And they're known for, Hoosiers are known for coming through in a crisis, not shrinking
they're shirking their responsibilities, not shrinking from doing what needs to be done. I know you're a history buff, as am I, and I'm looking at what your friend, my friend, and former podcast guest, Eric Holcomb, is doing in the governor's office, and confronted with the worst crisis for the state since the Civil War. I just am admiring that he's handling it like Oliver P. Morton handled the Civil War, resolutely, strongly, and make no apologies. This is what we have to do, but things will be better if we come together. You've known Governor Holcomb a long time. What do you think about what he's doing in the state and how he's leading the state?
Yeah, so I'm really impressed by his leadership and, you know, the daunting challenges that he's had to face. It wasn't too long ago that there was a Republican governor in a Western state who characterized the job of a governor as serving as the branch manager of the federal government. there's all funny sort of statements. There's a little bit of truth to that. And what I mean is being governor is a very powerful and important and significant position. But over the years, as our federal government has grown and adapted to a national economy and then a global economy, the federal government has circumscribed the responsibilities of our states in many respects. But in this unique moment, it is our governors we've been looking to for command leadership. And you mentioned the Civil War and Oliver Morton. Oliver Morton took the initiative. He wasn't able to assemble a state legislature, so he went out there and he raised money from the party chairman to continue the war effort because he had a deep conviction it was the right thing to do, and it was not without controversy. So similarly, Governor Holcomb has been leading in a difficult time. Henry Kissinger once said that the art of public leadership involves marching out in front of the parade, but not losing the parade behind you. And you know, sometimes it's a difficult balance because we know that there are so many competing equities and interests and concerns people have, public health and the economy, and the governor is doing all he can with great integrity and principle to strike that balance, to maintain people's confidence, to bring the parade along. And he's done it with some good humor too. And so I really have great respect for Eric, and I think he's earned the respect of a whole lot of people who may not have been aware of him on the front end of this or not particularly attentive to our state government leadership.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And you know, I don't mind saying that we have a nonpartisan podcast here. We've done terrific podcasts about Birch Bayh and with Bart Peterson and Kathy Davis. But it's certainly special for me as someone who's been involved in Republican politics now for more than a few decades to see folks like you, like Eric Holcomb and others prosper in this time and meet this challenge head on. One of the things that I was looking at in your bio was that you're a fifth generation Hoosier. So that means your family moved to Indiana about when? Mid to late 1800s?
So here's an interesting thing about that. It's interesting you bring that up, and you give me an opportunity to sort of correct my own record, because I believe, and I admit it, I'm the one who probably socialized that. It goes back more than five generations. Now, it would have been uncomfortable if it were two generations, right? Or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think a second generation Hoosier is a talking point, but
yeah,
I get
exactly,
it.
Exactly. But somebody recently footnoted my Wikipedia page, and I think it was one of my kiddos who actually brought it to my attention. And I looked it up, and I'd never researched my own family history. It was never of great interest to me for a particular reason. And because I had somewhere imbibed at an early age that to be an American means that each generation redefines itself. You know, the fact that my father or my grandfather might have been significant or insignificant should not be where I draw my self-worth from, right? It's my job to go out there with my God-given talents and try and build upon whatever foundation I'm given. And from that, you sort of define your life and your success. Because of my job, a lot of people ask me kind of where I came from, what my family history was, and so forth. So this was of interest to me as I saw the footnote. And I opened it up, and I descend from multiple generations. We're talking like sort of deep into the early 1800s, if I recall, of people who farmers, blacksmiths, tanners, you name it. People who generally worked with their hands so we've been around various parts of Indiana, all around the Northeast, the Southeast, Central, whatever, for a lot of generations, and too many for me to quite track. I wasn't quite sure how to track the document, but I love this state. I really do. And I have to admit, once I discovered that, it gave me a bit of a deeper connection to some of these places when I'd visit. Like, I descend from people that come from this region. And what a fantastic state we have with just salt of the earth people that helped build this country.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about when your family came around. One of my favorite books on the Civil War defined one of its chapters. Talked about how slavery geographically defined the Midwest. In revolutionary times, in the early 1800s, Indiana was the West. But because of the compromises leading that tried to address slavery leading up to the Civil War, Indiana became the North, along with Ohio and Illinois. It just shows you the impact that one particular issue had on how we saw ourselves as American geographically. Did you get the sense that you're based on your knowledge that your family moved west for a particular reason, that they started like in Philadelphia or New Jersey or a place like that closer to the time of the Revolutionary War and then just kind of gradually pushed out in search of land? Because that would be a common Hoosier lineage.
I would like to better understand that. I actually do not understand that, and I have not had an opportunity to research that. But I'm aware that the prospect of cheap land and the opportunity associated with the land, and then later came the legal protection of the land, the legal title, which is what caused Abraham Lincoln to migrate, his father to migrate north from Kentucky into Indiana. These sorts of things, these opportunities drove so many people west. But I did not. I don't know where my own family's history sort of, you know, emerged from.
Yeah. You mentioned this a few minutes ago, and I want to say this as a compliment. You have a reputation as someone who doesn't mind traveling the Hoosier State and shows up at events that you would never think a United States senator would show up to. But you have that. You have that drive to be with the folks and never forget where you came from. What is, before we talk about kind of your college and your military career a little bit, what's it like? You've traveled the Hoosier State as just a private citizen, then as a candidate for Congress, then a congressman, then a candidate for Senate, then a senator. What's that like? How do you feel you're received? And is it fun to go to the Mayberry Cafe and say, oh my God, it's Todd Young instead of Senator Young, where they feel comfortable with you because you've been there and you've demonstrated your willingness to sit down and have a conversation with people who'll tell it to you straight?
Yeah, I take pride in my ability to make people feel comfortable, right? Yeah, I think, you know, not everyone who approaches me knowing I'm a United States senator is initially comfortable, but I do feel like that I'm able to put people at ease. And I think there's a lot of that just comes from the family I grew up in. You know, we were taught, like so many people in this great state, that, you know, it's a quintessentially American sentiment. No one is better than any other man or woman. And gosh darn it, that was instilled in me. And that's part of what drives me to do different things and set different goals and try to accomplish those goals. But it also carries into how I relate to others. I really don't think I'm any better than anybody else. I don't think that my title somehow gives me higher status than others. In fact, it's even common for someone at a local level of government to refer to my office as a higher office. And I bristle a bit against that. It's just a different office. It's a different responsibility. We're all important. We all have very essential roles to play in this society, whether it's government or whether it's the person who picks up my garbage. You talk about an important role in society. If I didn't show up for work for a couple of months straight, people might not notice for a while.
Kenworthy would make sure they notice.
But I'll tell you, if my garbage weren't collected for a couple of months, can you imagine? I mean, that's really, so that puts things in perspective. Every job is quite important out there, and really everyone is important.
And you know, I want to say this because I'm going to guess you're going to agree 1,000%. The attitude that you just discussed with us is exactly the attitude of your predecessor, Dan Coats, former senator, two-time senator, former congressman as well, and Army veteran, is probably the most approachable person I've ever met who held that office. You would be along that way. Governor Holcomb is very approachable. Of course, I worked for the ultimate everyman, former Marine Lieutenant Colonel Greg Ballard. But Dan Coats was as grounded as any politician, public official I ever met. How well did you get to know him? And did you kind of see how he interacted with folks and go, you know what, he's getting this right?
So one of the things that I am impressed by, and not impressed in a normative, favorable or unfavorable way, but just like that I'm really struck by, is how, in my mind, the best leaders are people who don't try to pretend to be somebody else, who figure out how to be themselves and cultivate their own skills in furtherance of important values, shared values, right? And Dan Coats never put on any airs in his public capacity. He still doesn't to this day when I see him, you know. I think that is one of the reasons he was so successful as a leader. That's one of the reasons people liked him so much as a U.S. senator and director of national intelligence, and one of the reasons why fellow senators trusted the guy. He was trustworthy. He was humble. He's friendly. He had a good sense of humor, but he wasn't a wise guy. He wasn't a blowhard. Now, there are some of my colleagues, frankly, that are hams and posture and preen, and there's an authenticity to it. That's just who they are, right? And they can pull it off because that's who they are. So there are different types of leadership. It was one of the things that I studied when I entered the Navy and then went into the Naval Academy. And you've heard I served in the Marines, right, Robert?
I try not to tell anyone.
Okay. All right. So I didn't know if you were going to bring it up, but yeah.
There were certain subjects I was told by Kenworthy that weren't to be discussed. That was one of them. And your love of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Well, you know, not everyone can get into the Marines, but so Robert, you're a great American. You are a great American soldier, and I've got great respect for you. So listen, in the military, one of the things that I did, you probably did as well, is you'd look at different leaders and say, what makes that leader effective? Their personality is so different. Their demeanor is so different than this other leader. And I'd try and draw traits from leaders that I thought were replicable, that I thought maybe were consistent with my own sort of personality and amplify those. And I found that to be probably the best mode of training leaders, is just being around, immersed in a culture of leadership, right? Not trying to, in a book or in some sort of tutorial, learn how to be a typical type of leader. So just be true to yourself. So Dan Coates, he's a humble guy. He's kind of like a quintessential Midwesterner, right? Mm-hmm. Just what Hoosiers typically want in their leaders, whether it's business, government, nonprofit, whatever. And he brought that to bear and with energy and integrity over a number of years. And Mayor Ballard did the same sort of thing. And there's just tons of examples out there. A lot of our chief executives of major companies like Eli Lilly, they come from that mold.
Mm-hmm.
All the way down to guys like my dad. Of course, I'm biased, but he ran a small business for years, probably a half dozen employees at their height. And it was a sales business. And my dad, slightly different personality than me, a bit more of a ham. I always felt like he was jealous of me at Lincoln dinners when I go around hugging people and get to go up there and say a few words. Dad was actually kind of jealous. And I was like, Dad, it's not as glamorous as it looks sometimes, but.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction with our friend Paul Okeson, the Crown Plaza Hotel, Grand Hall, and Conference Center with our friend Jim Dora Jr., the law firm of Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, too many friends to mention. Our Eastsiders, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and the greatest of the great, P.E. McAllister. McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. You're listening to the Leaders and Legends podcast. We have our senior senator, Todd Young, lifelong Hoosier, fifth generation plus Hoosier. Senator Young, is there a Hoosier leader or legend you particularly admire?
Yeah, there are lots of them. Most of them are unsung. Most of them will never be on a ballot. Most of them will never occupy the C-suites. Most of them are toiling away with great anonymity without recognition for causes they believe deeply in. I'll give you an example. My aunt, who happens to be a prominent Democrat, by the way.
I'm kidding. Who?
Her name is Sharon Pierce. She's CEO of the largest children welfare children's services agency in the state, the Villages. They do adoption placement. They deal with foster children and so forth. And she's dedicated her life to helping children who often come from the most trying circumstances, oftentimes just put into a little better place, sometimes a much better place. And her life has given meaning to others' lives, but it's also given a lot of meaning to her own work. And so she's a mission-driven person. She knows how to motivate others. She's always offering encouragement to others, myself included. Everything she does is based on the service of others, achieving better outcomes for others, as opposed to feeding her personal ego. She uses the platform of this not-for-profit agency, the Villages, not to elevate herself, but instead to help others. And so I believe, as I think all conservatives should believe, in institutions, family,
sure,
business, church, neighborhood. There's just, you know, a multiplicity of important institutions. One of those institutions happens to be government. And you and I, Robert, in various capacities have felt called to serve at different times through government, not to elevate ourselves, not to create a cult of personality, but to serve. And so Sharon Pierce would be a fantastic example of that kind of servant leadership.
We talked to her earlier. I'm glad you mentioned that. And I hope she understands that we're going to reach out to her and get her, try to get her on the podcast. We'd love to talk to her. Your path to the Naval Academy is interesting in the sense that you joined the Navy first. Am I getting this correct? You joined the Navy right out of high school. I mean, like all of us, like, I don't know what the percentage would be, but I would imagine it's in the high 90s where people join the military right after high school. And that's what you did. And then you got appointed to the Naval Academy. Talk a little bit about that, because I've never heard that before. I know people who were enlisted that became officers, but not the path that you took.
So it's actually a fairly high percentage of service academy graduates when I was going through the Naval Academy had some prior form of service or higher education. Some people had spent a year at a state university or another college, and they were on the bubble to get into the academy. Others went to a private Northeastern prep school for a year to improve their SAT scores and so forth. But there are a number of incredibly sharp enlisted people, as you know, Robert, who serve in our military, oftentimes with PhDs. You know, they're
right.
Their letters by far outrank and outstack and outclass those of those who nominally outrank them, their officers. And so one thing that the academies have commendably done over the years is tried to pull people out of the enlisted ranks who want to continue their education and get a formal four-year degree. And one way of doing that is by giving them a year of sort of like training at this preparatory school in Newport, Rhode Island. And so this was stood up generations ago to ensure that people aren't directly leaving a destroyer and showing up at Annapolis and taking advanced math. They need a transition period. So this preparatory school is something they gave this young Hoosier an opportunity to attend, along with a bunch of enlisted folks. As an enlisted man, you know, almost on day one, I was there going through that training environment. So my time as an enlisted person in the Navy, though I wore the dungarees and in the Dixie cap and so forth, I don't want to overstate that service. That was schooling. It was a fantastic experience. I mean, I was spending time around a lot of these sailors and some Marines who had a lot more life experiences than I did, right?
And one of the things that people don't realize unless you've been in, I mean, you can obviously read about it, so I don't want to hyperbolize it too much, but my son did two tours in Afghanistan as a infantryman in the Army, first AD, Old Ironsides. And you and I, you've been very kind in mentioning his service to me when I would see you when he was overseas and you would ask how he was doing. And it's very, very, very kind of you. But one of the things that folks don't realize about being in the military, even as a private or corporal, the lower of the ranks, you're in charge of multi-million dollar equipment. Tens and tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money is being entrusted to you on a daily basis, whether you're a tanker or an artillery man or a drone operator or the list goes on and on. I get the sense that teaches you a bit of responsibility that maybe you don't get in the civilian world. Would you agree with that or no?
I was awestruck by that. In fact, I still see that in my day job today as well. In fact, I was recently visiting Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Oman and some countries there in the Persian Gulf area. And I had an opportunity to take a hop in a helicopter out to one of our destroyers in the Persian Gulf at during a very tense period between the United States and Iran as we were ratcheting up our pressure campaign. So I spent half a day on this destroyer, and I went to the bow of the ship where there's a massive, you know, 60 cal, I think, machine gun. And that's used, if necessary, to shoot down an incoming corvette vessel that may be armed with all sorts of explosives and so
sure.
And so there have been times when, according to the captain of the ship, that machine gun, which is manned by, like, you know, a seaman, you know, a very young person, mm-hmm. a few ranks up out of high school, had to make a decision with a loaded weapon whether or not to fire on this vessel. You could hear them speaking Farsi, I think, from the
sure.
the vessel. And to put that amount of responsibility in the hands of one individual, I think, is just not fully appreciated, not fully understood by most people who see their classmates from high school go off and say, yeah, I'm joining the Navy. Well, do you have an idea how much responsibility your friend just might have? It's a big deal.
Or, the, you know, the people who are dealing with the fighter planes coming back on the carriers. I mean, the list goes on and on. A really good friend of mine named John Duns was a year behind me at Howe. He did 6 years in a submarine. I mean, the equipment on these vessels is just worth an immense amount of money. And it's also concomitant with an immense amount of responsibility. And I've said this, I don't know anyone who has disagreed with this statement. And, you know, growing up on the East Side in Indianapolis, I couldn't name them all, but so many of my friends joined the military out of pride, out of necessity, whatever reason. Scott Kale, Leanne Wilhelm, DJ Waterman, Dean Johnson, John Duns, Pete Anderson. I honestly couldn't name them all. There are dozens of them. To a man, including the conversations I've had with people in politics who were in the service, you, Eric Holcomb, Richard Lugar, Greg Ballard, the best decision they ever made, joining the military. Best professional decision they ever made, to a man. No one has regretted it. They've all said, man, I'm so glad I did this. Would you agree that your decision to take that path, as opposed to going to a different university and taking a different path, that shaped you and changed you in ways that you could never have replicated any other way?
Yeah. I mean, it's defined who I am as a person. I spent my last roughly year in the military, of all things, doing recruiting duty. That's difficult duty, frankly. It was a lot more challenging than serving as an intelligence officer. One of the things that I would say during the booming 90s economy to University of Chicago students or Northwestern students who I was trying to recruit into the U.S. military was prefer the hard, you know, put yourself through the crucible. I cannot explain to you exactly what sort of person you'll be on the back end of this experience, but I guarantee that the fire will make you a stronger person, right? I believe that emotionally, physically, intellectually.
And just the people you meet.
I
met the best people in the military.
The esprit de corps, that of course sticks with you. It's something I'm not sure I've heard someone say they regret serving their country, especially being prepared to put your life on the line for your country. I mean, that says, and then serving with others of the same mind, So it is, it's certainly a life-shaping experience. There's no doubt I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now, but for that time in the military. And that stayed with me when I left the military, that desire to kind of serve in a public capacity.
And does that, is that something that, that crosses political lines? I mean,
yes.
Democrats serve their country too. It's not just Republicans. And, you know, when you see Tammy Duckworth, or you meet a John Kerry, or you meet whomever who in the Senate or Congress, I mean, Indiana has got some terrific veterans who have served, Lugar, Coates, the list, Baird, who's the fourth district guy, and many others. But is that something when you see a Democrat and he was in the Marines or he joined the Naval Academy, it's like, okay, politics is politics, but let's go make fun of some Army guys.
Absolutely. I think Andy Jacobs probably had that come out of his mouth many times. Let's go make fun of some Army guys.
Oh, he was insufferable.
So, yeah, look, I think it's quite, you know, there are a lot of my colleagues who put country first and they are comfortable putting partisanship aside in furtherance of really important national objectives. So I would never go so far as to suggest that in order to be a patriot, you have to serve in the military, right?
Of course. Good point.
But I do think that, I think that there's a certain facility, and ease, that comes with just identifying a mission, setting aside your tribes and saying, look, we all got to work together. You know, you came from New Jersey. I came from Indiana. That person over there, they came from Arizona. We've never met one another. Here's the mission. We're going through the fire together. We're all in this together. Let's do the right thing. You know, that just feels like the military spirit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. My three roommates in the military were Black. One was from Detroit, one was from Chicago, and one was from basically Miami, Florida. And I got roasted routinely and enjoyed every second of it. And we still stay in touch to this degree as much as we can 30 years later. And I'll never forget just being with them and laughing and watching sports and playing cards. And it's an experience, even though the east side of Indianapolis is very diverse, and IPS is, and how high school certainly was, it was just different. And it's something that I encourage every single young person, man or woman, to do. Also, I would also say, quite frankly, I got two college degrees with no student loan debt. So if you're worried about impending student loan debt, call one of your local recruiters, because you'll get a twofer in ways that you can't possibly imagine.
You know, there's something else I'd add, and we can pivot if you like, Robert. But one of the things that I learned in the military is service isn't service until it's not fun, until it's really hard, until it's actual sacrifice, right? You know, jumping out of airplanes is for many fun. Scuba diving is a lot of fun. You know, I see these promotional videos on TV about joining the Marines, and that looks fun. Well, a lot of things I did in the military were really boring and not always a lot of fun, right? And so that sacrifice, that's love of country, that's service, to be able to perform those responsibilities with the same amount of professionalism and competence and hard work as all the other more glamorous duties.
One of my favorite statistics, I was the then Congressman candidate Mike Pence asked me to be the head of his Veteran Affairs Policy Committee when he was running for governor in 2012. And in the doing the research, so this statistic's old, but still valid, more valid because the number has grown. More than 2 million Americans volunteered for the military after 9/11, since 9/11. Those young men and women who volunteered, could be going to combat, could be going overseas. That is a remarkable testament to the American sense of service.
It is. It is, and it gives you a sense of a couple of things. Let's go ancient for a second. There are martial virtues and there are dull virtues. Martial virtues, you think of the warrior virtues, the courage, right? The camaraderie, the adventure, the quest to engage in a righteous fight, right? And hunger for that experience. For many of us, it's easy to identify with that. The dull virtues are sort of respecting one's elders, right? Mm-hmm. Reverence for things that are either holy or sacred or just ought to be revered. Respect, personal integrity. These are dull virtues. These should be equally celebrated, right? And they're an equal sort of part for me of what the military experience is all about. And I think it's so commendable and encouraging to see people raise their hand and say, I want to be part of all of that.
Yeah. Terrific. That's exactly. And you'll never, if you want diversity in your life, join the military, because you will meet all kinds of people. And it's something that Indiana in its history, I think we still have the fourth largest National Guard in the country, and we're not even in the top half in population or very close. It's typical of us. You attended the Naval Academy. You walked around. It's a beautiful place in Annapolis. Did you get a sense, or did you ever walk around from class to class or when you were on duty and go, John McCain was here, Chester Nimitz was here, and you know, we could go on with the list of the heroes and the veterans and the Medal of Honor recipients who took classes where you took classes and served duty where you served duty?
I didn't do a lot of that. No. I was fear is a great motivator. And I always thought, I still think my strengths are kind of arts and letters, words, writing, history, current events, these sorts of things. The Naval Academy is an engineering school. I mean, I studied electrical engineering, weapon systems engineering, rocket science. literally, that was my worst class, by the way. Yeah.
So can I say the Senate is not rocket science?
Yeah, the Senate is not rocket science. And oh, by the way, rocket science is not brain surgery. All right. So anybody can figure it out. It just takes a whole lot of work. So this was a very tough experience for me. But it was, for me in particular, I would say, a real boost in my self-confidence for somebody who had to beg and claw their way into the Naval Academy. I drove all the way out to the Naval Academy after getting multiple what were effectively brush offs and rejection letters from the administration. Drove out there with my dad and showed up, and they said, who are you? I'm the guy who's been writing you, and I'm going to go to the Naval Academy. That's how the prep school came about and so forth.
Sure.
And so I kind of, through initiative was and a lot of good fortune, was able to finagle my way in. And it must have been a weak recruiting year too, but got in. And I had 4 good years there to work on my weaknesses, and ended up finishing top 20% of my class. But that's a huge confidence builder when you're surrounded by valedictorians and salutatorians and people who got into Harvard and Yale. And, you know, I went to a good public school, but I was definitely not that caliber of student on day one. In fact, I was barely getting by. So I didn't have a lot of time to reflect on, you know, the leaders in Granite, nor did I have, candidly, a family background. I didn't have admirals or generals in my family. So I didn't have the confidence that my career trajectory was going to be great if I didn't excel in everything every day.
Yeah. Did you, at what point you joined the Marines? So after you graduate, you can choose Navy or the Marine Corps. At what point do you have to choose, and why did you choose the Marines?
I knew I was going to do something, whether that was the Navy SEALs, Special Warfare, or the Marines. It was pretty much going to be one of those two that involved physical activity, that involved, I hoped, some of that martial stuff, some of the adventure. And I went through the SEAL summer program. I went through the Marine Corps summer programs, and they were both great. So that's kind of how I settled on those two. I was not so much into the math and engineering stuff. You do a lot of that in most of the other Navy areas. So being a pilot involves a lot of math, and it didn't seem to involve, although there are a lot of fit pilots out there, it didn't seem to involve a lot of kind of exercise, on the ground exercise. And so that's always been a big part of my life. So it was sort of that simple. I like being outdoors. A lot of people choose the Army for that same reason, right? They want to be on the ground around the troops. And I still enjoy that. I still enjoy being on the ground with the troops, with my, you know, fellow rank and file Hoosiers, and as opposed to, you know, in some other more kind of like artificial atmosphere.
So have you gone back to Annapolis as a United States Senator and kind of walked around and talked to the folks and said, hey, look, stick it out, because you never know what can happen next?
You know, I'd like to go back and spend a little more time. I went back as a congressman and had some lunch with some Hoosiers in the largest dining hall in the country, King Hall there. I've been back and gave a couple of years of service to the advisory board that I sat on. So did that. Been to a couple of football games. Saw us crush Air Force. I think it was last season. And I go to the Notre Dame Navy game every year. So, but you know, it's a really, as you said, it's a beautiful place. It is. It's a place a lot of my classmates don't go back to on a regular basis. They still talk about it because it's such a tough place. It brings mixed emotions to a bunch of folks.
That's interesting.
But, yeah, it's a great place to be from. It's not always a great place to be at. There's a wall around it, and a lot of people think that wall is designed to keep outsiders from going in.
You made a decision about a decade ago that has got to be one that involves your family, your wife and kids, your parents, your friends, that I have real admiration for, especially in this day and age. And that is, you decided to put your name on the ballot. You had earned your law degree, at several degrees. You'd been over in London. You had demonstrated a real commitment to education, bettering yourself. But when you put your name on the ballot to run for United States Congressman, for United States Congress, excuse me, that is a whole nother level of, dare I say, exposure. Talk to us a little bit about that decision. You were up against a very, very strong Democrat congressman, Barron Hill, who had won the seat, lost the seat, won it back, but had kind of a strangled hold on the 9th district, which is where you're running. How hard was that decision for you, and did you ever regret it immediately after you did it?
No, I never regretted it immediately after I did it. And I made the announcement that I was going to run for the 9th congressional district seat of Indiana in January of 2009. That's really early, right? Because the election wasn't obviously until November of 2010. Some of that was a function of inexperience. Some of that was a function of the fact that I lacked a net worth and a network.
Is it okay to say that I never heard of you until you decided to run for Congress?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I was like, Todd Young, you mean Sajjal's not running again? Who are we going to get down in the 9th? And they said, Todd Young. And I said, what's his background? And they said he was in the Marines. And I go, oh, okay, God. I started laughing. I'm like, you know, the Marine Corps has the best brand in the world. They just do. I hate it, but they have the best brand in the world. And I said to myself, I'm like, it's going to take a veteran who's going to work his tail off to beat Barron Hill in the 9th. Yeah. And I think that was one of the best things you had going for you.
Yeah, you know, I had the work ethic. And so because I began early in January of 2009, it gave me an opportunity to practice law, which is what I was doing for that fairly short period of my life, for about 2 years. But practice law out of my Jeep as I traveled around a district larger than the state of Connecticut. You know, I mean, I can remember pulling my laptop out and file folders out in subways and doing a little law work, and then, you know, calling some people, making some friends, seeing if they can bring some others in. So I just made friends for about 6 months to 8 months, and all around the district. Prominent business people, people that happen to be involved in the party, government leaders and others. And then, you know, if you're really going to run a campaign, you have to start bringing in resources. So I started to do that and identify people who might consider helping me on the ground. And the thing grew and grew and grew. And one of the traits that Napoleon most appreciated in his generals, you know what it was, Robert? It was the most important quality in his generals.
I would say audacity.
Oh, that's a good guess, actually. I probably would have guessed something like that, too.
Napoleon famously told one of his generals, came up to Napoleon one time and said, "I don't know where the enemy is. I don't know how many enemy there are." And Napoleon looked at him and said, "Attack him and find out."
Well, I think you need audacity. So that's absolutely, and if you're going to really achieve anything remarkable or notable in life. But in this instance, it was the preeminent quality of luck. He needed his generals to be lucky. And I was lucky that I worked really hard, that I built that team, that I started bringing in money at the time the Tea Party movement hit. Right. And so, because of every ounce of energy I'd put into that race, and I needed it in the end, I won. Let me see. You don't forget something like this, right? It was, right. It was 34% of the vote in the primary to 32, which is number, the person who came in second was actually Travis Hankins.
Yeah.
To 30, Mike Sodrel, former congressman, man for whom I have great respect. And then, there was another candidate, Rick Warren, not to be confused with the megachurch pastor, very nice guy. He received 4% of the vote, and so I got across the line. Was fortunate that things worked out for me, and then I had the general election battle, the battle royale against Barron.
Yeah. Well, and we want to mention this too, because I want to make sure that we don't forget to talk about this aspect of your life, and someone who I know you admire greatly, and I do. He's frequently, when I ask the question about, is there a Hoosier leader or legend you particularly admire, the name we've heard most often is Richard Lugar. And you have had a long history with him, worked for him. How did he shape your sense of political service and public service and give you the confidence you needed? A, because you see what a really good man can do in public service, and also to take on a formidable candidate in Barron Hill.
So I spent a year and a half, about 2 years, working for Senator Lugar right after I got out of the Marines. That was my first real job. And I advised him. He didn't need a lot of advice on a couple of policy issues, right? So I had a front row seat to see how he operated. And he was a guy who was comfortable in his own skin, who, as I said earlier, he used his own skills in a way that was authentic to him. Dick Lugar was never kind of a populist, flame-throwing politician. He's a soft-spoken man, cerebral, and I learned from him the importance of building trusted, positive relationships with people on all sides of the political aisle, within Congress and outside of Congress, including back home. I learned from him the importance of being authentic and true to yourself in a profession known for sort of blowhards. He never was one. And he did not use the institution of the United States Senate to elevate himself. It was always to elevate issues, notably nuclear nonproliferation. That became sort of the signature issue for which I think he is rightly known. I also learned from him the importance of actually learning things, you know, actually trying to learn an issue before you open your mouth and opine superficially about it, right? And he did have a real command of the issues. Much of that was just a function of his intellect and his attention and pride in learning issues. I also got a sense of a measure of the man's humanity. He always treated staff like myself respectfully and understood that he was part of a broader team.
Mitch Daniels said that in the podcast we did with Governor Daniels. We didn't actually get to Mitch Daniels' time as governor. We hope to do a podcast on that when he's less busy. But he mentioned that about how Lugar treated the staff. It was very gracious, very like, let's help. You know, it's time for you to move on. How can we help you? You know, you need to do the next great thing in your life. And the list of people who worked for Senator Lugar or Mayor Lugar reads like a Hoosier's who's who of people who've done great work. Teresa Lubbers, Sue Ann Gilroy, Jim Morris, Todd Young, Mitch Daniels, the list goes on and on.
So there's a lesson there too, which is either know how to hire well or hire people who hire well. And he did that. And you know, clearly many people applied to work for Senator Lugar because he was such a great man by reputation, by his every action and so forth. But he also got a lot of help along the way, and he deserves credit for that, right? For empowering others around him to hire good people, holding them accountable along the way. And that's how he built his legacy over a number of years. And so there are a lot of things that Dick Lugar could have done with his life and been very successful. I can remember a conversation I had with his chief of staff, Marty Morris, once. And he said, look, Lugar, he could be a successful CEO, which I believe could have been successful and, you know, head of a university. But he chose this, and we should all be grateful that he chose that.
We want to be very respectful of the senator's time, and we wanted to. I want to ask one quick question about your Senate run in 2016. It was going to be against Barron Hill again, but Evan Bayh came in, and you ended up winning in what was a good year for Republicans. I remember that day. And there were a lot of Democrats walking downtown with a big smile on their face. And we hope to have Evan Bayh on the podcast one day, so we don't want to be disrespectful. But they were for sure they were going to win that race. How did you win it? How did you and your team win that race?
I still feel like we had the advantage day one. Evan Bayh entered with $10 million in the race. And incidentally, I've got a very positive relationship with Evan. I've never That's had good. A race against anybody who I haven't made great efforts to develop a friendship on the back end. I've developed a genuine friendship with Evan Bayh. And so I also want to say that. I had a deep conviction. And normally my convictions are informed by facts. Right. I try to be a very objective person and not subject to overconfidence biases and so forth. But this one was deeper than that. This one was, we've got this. We've got this. We've worked too hard. I see no other path than victory on this. And I think that enthusiasm made a difference, not only in my own personal efforts. I think that the team understood that it was going to be all right, that we were going to win. It was just going to take nonstop, concerted effort and concentration. It was going to take no mistakes between Evan Bayh's entry and Election Day. It was going to take the tightest sort of teamwork any of us had ever enjoyed, maybe extending back to sort of a kind of a military commitment.
Sure.
And it was just going to be all in for everyone, and we were going to win. And I've never felt such certitude in such otherwise adverse circumstances than I felt the moment after going through a drive-through, picking up a cup of coffee, and getting the phone call from the gent who effectively managed my campaign, Cam Savage, saying, "Todd," very calmly, "just want to let you know," he gave me some throwaway information. He said, "I also want to let you know we got another another opponent." "What do you mean another opponent?" He said, yeah, you know, Baron Hill's out of the race and Evan Bayh's entered. And I said, how did that happen? And he said, "Well, it's just, you know, it just did. And he's got $10 million and he was calm and I was calm." And I said, "Okay, we're going to win." I went right back to making fundraising calls, and we all set on a course of getting it done. So there's also a certain peace, I have to say, during times of sort of adversity like that. There was an expectation I was going to beat Baron Hill. I also have a positive relationship with Baron Hill, but
I think you're exactly right.
Yeah, there was an expectation. So there, it was therefore a pressure on me that I was going to blow it, right? I knew no one thought I was going to beat Evan Bayh, but I felt like I was going to beat Evan Bayh. So suddenly, it's like playing sports when you're loose, right? The ball starts going in a lot more, mm-hmm. right? And so I was loose. I'm like, "Hey, I got this thing. No one thinks I've got it. And this is an opportunity to do something that is incredibly impactful. The control of the United States Senate, we have to assume, is going to come down to this race." And we operated under that assumption.
Well, with Jay Kenworthy and Trevor Foudy and Cam Savage and my former boss, Kevin Ober, and all the people who helped you, you were in very, very good hands. And no one can say that Todd Young took on the Washington Generals to get where he was or to win office, to beat Baron Hill in Congress in the 9th when he did, and then to beat Evan Bayh, who is one of the very few people to win statewide in Indiana 4 times, is a murderer's row, with all due respect, of opponents. Let's get quickly to the 5 questions when we let you go, because I know you have other things going on. I will quickly say you are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana. That's our friends Danielle Shockey and Garmon Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel and Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney & Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. We ask the same 5 questions of every guest. So, Todd, number 1, what was your first job?
Well, you've probably heard this in promotional videos and so forth, but it is indeed the case. You know, like a lot of kiddos, I mowed lawns, I took care of dogs, I did all kinds of things like that, but probably the first, you know, the biggest job I had was, my dad had an office building, and he only operated in a small part of it. He'd rent the rest of it out to others. This is back in the day. I was in early days of junior high school, 6th grade, 7th grade or something. And it was a lot cheaper to pay your son to be janitor of this big old office building. It's actually in the Broderpool area now. It's right across from the old Burger Chef. So John Mutz, remember the very location, being the owner of that Burger Chef. But it would take me hours and hours to clean those ashtrays and toilets and that kind of stuff. And it gave me a great respect for what people who work with their hands do, right? It was hard work. It wasn't fun work. I wasn't paid much money. I took a little bit of satisfaction on the back end. As I got older, though, I really appreciated what people who did that sort of work and who do that sort of work, you know, how hard it is. And for people who do that work well, it just gives me an incredible appreciation for them and their character. So that was my first job. And you might say being a janitor and cleaning toilets is pretty good training to be a U.S. senator.
Lots of messes in both places. Yeah. Second question, what was your first concert?
It was at Deer Creek. Remember that? It's gone through many iterations since. It's been Klipsch and all the other stuff. But Deer Creek Music Center in Noblesville, when nothing else was around there, it was a Steve Miller Band.
Hey, that's not bad.
No, it's not bad. I invited a young lady. I still remember this. Invited a young lady to go out with me to the concert. She had some other commitment. And so I invited my best friend to come along, and he and I had a great time. Yeah.
your fellow Marine Greg Ballard's first concert when he was at IU was Sly and the Family Stone.
Oh, wow.
Number three, if you could suggest any book for someone to read, which book would you recommend?
You know, this one might for some people be a little boring, but it's short. And it's really accessible. It's called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. I mean, it takes very, very little time to read. And you go through it and you have a much better appreciation for the world of economics than a lot of people who get master's degree in the subject.
Number four. I'll leave aside the fact that the Marine is recommending a short book that's easy to read.
It's really grand, too.
Number four, if you could witness any event in history, be there as it happens, which event would you choose?
Robert E. Lee surrendering to Ulysses S. Grant, not out of animus towards Robert E. Lee, but because of the importance of how the occasion came together and the dignity by which it was carried out. Robert E. Lee went into that looking at all of the other sort of rebel leaders throughout history. And typically they had lost their heads. And we're talking about unconditional surrender Grant being on other side of this, right? But Robert E. Lee decided that the nation had had enough. And I think that for all of his other flaws and for the flaw of his cause more broadly, retrospectively, he does deserve credit for that. And U.S. Grant deserves credit for allowing a measure of face to be saved by the South. You know, it's quite plausible. And there's a book out there by Jay Winnick.
It's terrific.
April 1865, the walk through all of this, right? Mm-hmm. But that war could have very easily turned into, you know, what we now call terrorist warfare or unconditional warfare. It could have gone on for really generations of unconventional warfare. Instead, it came to an end because of the ritual and because of leadership and the mutual respect that those military leaders showed one another. So to be there in that room, in that living room where the war ended would have been absolutely fascinating in Appomattox Courthouse.
When Mr. Chris Spangle interviewed me for this podcast and he asked me this question, that was the event I chose for every single one of the reasons that you just described, because some of Lee's officers wanted them to hide in the hills and carry on the war. And Lee said no. And Grant showed such magnanimity when it came to what was the bloodiest war in our history. But he said after people started cheering when Lee left, Grant told his officers to stop the cheering because the rebels are our countrymen again. And that's the exact right sentiment that needed to be expressed. Perfect answer. Last question. If you could have dinner with anyone living today, 2 hours off the record, whom would you choose?
I get to have dinner in my job with some remarkable people. The CEOs of multinational companies. I had lunch not too long ago with Bill Gates. It was unguarded. He stopped by a Senate lunch. So the people I don't get to spend as much time with as I would like to are my children. So the least amount of time I have left are my two oldest children. So it would be my daughter, Abigail, who's almost 14, and my other daughter, Ava, who is 12.
We talked earlier in the podcast as we wrap it up about Todd Young and his approach to things and his persona and his personality. And I'll say this very quick story. I saw the senator about a year ago at a gym, and we talked very briefly. I was about to play racquetball. It was a gym on the south side of Indianapolis, and we had a quick 2-minute conversation. And afterward, as I sat down to prepare to play racquetball, a friend of mine goes, "Hey, who's your friend? I saw you guys talking. He looks really familiar." I go, "Yeah." I said, "I've known him for about 10 or 12 years. Great guy." I go, "But he's got kind of an important job. I didn't want to keep him." He goes, "Well, he seemed like he was just kind of hanging out. What's his job?" And I laughed and go, "He's the senior senator from the state of Indiana." And this guy simply couldn't believe it. Not because we were at a gym, not because he didn't know who he was per se, but because of Senator Young's easygoing nature, the genuineness of his personality, and the fact that he could be talking to anyone in the world, but he took just a couple minutes to talk to an old friend. I very much appreciated that conversation, as I did the conversations we've had about my son's service in Afghanistan and being in the military, and the fact that you took some time to be with us today. Thank you very much. And I hope we can come back another time. We'd love to talk to you about more things when the time is right.
That'd be great, Robert. It's been a lot of fun. And thank you for your service. Thank you for this opportunity. And for those who are watching and or listening, God bless you. Stay safe during this pandemic. And know that it really is a privilege to serve this great state of Indiana, serve this country.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.